Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
I'm bringing home a baby bumblebee. Won't my mommy be so proud of me? I'm bringing home a baby bumblebee. Ouch! He stung me. I'm squishing up a baby bumblebee. Won't my mommy be so proud of me? I'm squishing up a baby bumblebee. Ew, he's chewy. I'm licking up a baby bumblebee. Fly, blow, bleep, bleep, blow, blow, bleep. Blind, bleep, bleep, blow, bleep, 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 blum, blow, bleep. He's yummy.
I'm bringing home a baby bumblebee. Bum, 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 baby bumblebee. Jumbo,
ladies and gentlemen, we're screwed. Oh.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Andy's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a pierogi's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere. It's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. If he saw a shadow this morning, there will be six more weeks of gridlock in Washington, D.C. Here he is, Mike Novak.
We have a bell alert. The bell is... I broke it again. It's not that I break it. It's just that the dinger... See, you can hear the dinger rattling around in it. And the only person who knows how to fix this is Lisa. Although I did accidentally fix it once. And I'm still trying to figure out how I did that. Because this is... Wait a second. I could sit here all, you know, for 2 hours and just try to fix the bell, and that would be entertaining radio, wouldn't it?
Well, Mike, I think we should have an alternate sound, an alternate noise, and I'll try to think of one.
An alternate noise, huh?
Instead of a bell. I don't know.
I don't know. This is old school. See, we're trying to do that. Wait. Did I come close? Look at that. I fixed it while I was sitting here.
I know.
Just chatting. Just, you see, all I need is somebody to... To like, vamp for me a little bit for a couple of seconds.
You need some cheers.
And Cheerios.
Cheers and Cheerios.
Cheerios in the morning. That is the lovely Carol Brewer.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm not even going to do the Mouseketeer roll call because there's only two of you here.
Okay.
Rob Carthal is here. Rob.
Hey.
How you doing, buddy?
Oh, we're great.
Yeah? What's been going on?
Oh, just, you know, the usual community gardening, running around and... building stuff, kind of routine.
Yeah, I know you got some deals coming up, some interesting stuff.
Yeah, the Humboldt Park Garden Tour on September 7th, Growing Pride, putting
yeah?
it together.
Is this open to the public?
Oh, it is. It's open to anyone and everyone in Humboldt Park or elsewhere. If you like gardening or potlucks, or tie-dyeing T-shirts or flower demonstrations or any of the many things that we're going to have going on. It's going to be a fun time.
That's great. Well, you know, and how do people find out about this and get more information?
How do people find out about this?
Here on the radio show, right, you're talking about it, obviously.
Yeah. We're going to be putting together some flyers and putting them all around Humboldt Park. But I know that El Coqui, El Yunque, Mozart Community Garden, Monarch Community Garden, Thomas Street Garden, all those are pretty for sure in. And there should be other little things. We'll probably have like a little map with a suggested bike tour and stuff like that, and look for it in coffee shops and garden centers around Humboldt Park and things like that.
All right. And website or anything that the folks should know about that stalk you, go to your home, and
we'll probably end up Facebooking it on any of the community involved gardens that have Facebook pages. I'm not really onto Facebook. I know Growing Pride does not yet have a website. It's on our agenda of things to do.
All right. Well, you got to keep me posted and make sure that on the show folks know about this. So,
thanks.
Okay.
Will do.
Speaking of Twitter, I don't know why it does this. I got TweetDeck here. For all of you, those of you who are on Twitter, and I know a lot of you who are listening are not, but a lot of you are. And sometimes this happens. I've got the latest tweet is a day ago, and I know we've had a bunch of interactions. And I don't know why it does that. It just, you know, sometimes I turn it on and it's, why have I got a day ago? And yet, well. Today, we got a lot going on the show. And you heard the beginning, the baby bumblebee thing. Do parents still teach that to kids? Anybody know? I know we got at least one parent in the room, maybe a couple.
I am a parent, and
did you ever teach that to your kid? I'm squishing up a baby bumblebee.
No, sorry,
that's not 21st century anymore. Yeah. I mean, we that used to be what we taught kids. Not so much anymore. Today, the guy sitting across from me in the studio wrote this book that I'm holding in my hands.
That's great radio.
Oh, well, wait a second.
That's great radio.
Thank you. I'm going to shut off your mic now. I was going to tell folks what the book was. I know we're not on camera. We may do that someday. It's called Straw Bale Gardens, The Breakthrough Method for Growing Vegetables Anywhere Earlier and with No Weeding.
So that always gets them, the no weeding.
The no weeding. Well, there have been other books that have said... Lee Reich wrote a book, Weedless Gardening, but it wasn't about straw bales, okay? So we'll get to the author. That is Joel Karsten, who you just heard. And if you have any questions about it, 773-763-9278, and we'll talk about that book. And then in the second hour, something I've been looking forward to for a very long time. And that is, we're going to finally have that discussion about bees. That's why I played that little thing at the top of the show. This will be a lot more serious than, I'm squishing up a baby bumblebee. I have Dr. May Barenbaum, who is the head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. Jeffrey Pettis, research leader in bee research, USDA. In Beltsville, Maryland, Zach Browning, a fourth-generation commercial beekeeper out of North Dakota with more than 20,000 hives, and Dr. Mark Whalen from Michigan State University. He's the director of the Pesticide Alternatives Lab, which is pretty cool, working in organic methods there at Michigan State. And we're all going to talk about the decline of the honeybee. And I will ask the question, are honeybees really in trouble? Is this when do we get to make the pronouncement and say, yeah, we've crossed a line here. We're dealing with a really, really serious situation. So they will be on, and that's going to be pretty much the whole 10 o'clock hour. So if you got questions about bees, you're a beekeeper, you have been concerned about this. Time magazine just came out with a big article, cover story, about bees, this week, and on. Yeah, lots going on about that. So, and of course, there seems to be a new study every week. We've talked about in this show how give him a book to hold if you're going to take his picture. Hold up your book there. All right, you know,
good idea.
I've got Carol doing our PR here behind the scenes and taking photos.
Thanks.
But, you know, we all kinds of studies coming out. We had 50,000 bees lost in Oregon, basically due to stupidity, as far as I can tell. We'll find out if that's true. And on and on. So get ready with your bee questions for the second hour. And then towards the end of the hour, I'm going to bring in Jordan Parker from the Bring Your Bag Chicago campaign. I've been working on that, which is to try to get plastic bags, make plastic bags a thing of the past in the city of Chicago. And she's at this art event called Figment. You guys familiar with Figment?
No, I'm not.
That's at the Garfield Park. They have an installation of plastic bags. And how many plastic bags, you ask, and what are we talking about? Well, the number, and maybe we should do this later, but it's 2,568, which represents the number of plastic bags handed out in Chicago every minute. 2,568, yes. And Joel's us going, woo. Yeah, that's a lot. That's why we have to stop this. Stop the madness. Yeah. So she'll be on at the end of the show to talk about where that's going in their Indiegogo campaign to raise some funds. So here we are. Joel Karsten, the author of Straw Bale Gardens. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike.
You were up in Milwaukee the other day?
I was, yeah.
What was going on there?
Well, you had a little TV appearance on the morning show.
I don't have the cameras here, dude. This is low rent compared to that.
Hey, you got a long reach.
I hope so. Actually, I do. Not just Chicago, but all over the country. And you can find out when you see the people who tweet in and call in and talk to me. And by the way, you can always tweet it at Mike Now. Or go on Facebook to The Mike Novak Show. And if you got questions, we'll try to handle them. Interesting concept, Joel.
What do you think? Are you ready to switch your gardens over and try straw bale gardening?
I'm not sure. Maybe I need the final push from you, okay? First of all, we have, you know, I almost feel like I should do a contest here. Because I have an extra copy of the book, and I think maybe we should give one away. And I think I know what the first question is.
All right.
773-763-9278. What's the difference between straw and hay?
Well, that's a good one.
What's the difference between straw and hay?
You know, my theory has always been that the closer you get to the country's tallest buildings, the harder it is for people to distinguish between straw and hay.
I read that in your book, and I took it personally, I got to tell you. I took it personally. I'm a city kid, all right?
I can't tell you how many times I've done a seminar or class, and people will walk in, and they'll say, I'm here for the hay bale gardening class. And I say, well, you know, we really try to get straw bales if possible. And they say, well, straw and hay, that's exactly the same thing, isn't it? No, it's not. The
nope.
difference is cats and dogs.
I know.
I do.
We go back to that.
They're the same size. They're both on a farm. They're both in a barn. They're both the same shape. I can understand the confusion.
So, if you want a copy of the book, Straw Bale Gardens, The Breakthrough Method for Growing Vegetables Anywhere Earlier and with No Weeding, 773-763-9278. Give us the call. Tell us the difference between straw and hay. And if you live in the city, I'll give you bonus points. I'll probably go ding, give you. I keep leaving that. I'm not sure I get that. There we go. That's better. What made you write this book? I mean, you grew up on a farm, obviously dealing with bales, it's one of the things you talk about in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But there must have been an aha moment.
Well, I'll tell you, I've been doing this for 20 years, straw bale gardening, and it isn't until about 6 years ago that anybody even really cared. But
And I have to admit, you're not the only one in the country doing this. I'm doing a little research, I found a Facebook page yesterday. I was looking for yours.
Yep.
And there's somebody else who's got a huge following.
Yeah, there's a lot of people straw bale gardening now at this point.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid, probably 8 or 9 years old, when you grow up on a dairy farm and crop farm like I did.
And where was it?
Down in southwestern Minnesota, a little tiny rural area by Worthington, actually about a couple miles from Iowa. So we were really close to being from Iowa.
Almost by accident, you were in Minnesota, right?
I could throw a rock across the road and hit Iowa from our furthest farm.
And they would probably put you in jail for it, too.
Yeah. When you grow up on a crop farm, dairy farm, and you're a young kid, it's a proud day when you get to stack your first rack of bales all by yourself. Dad lets you up on the rack by yourself. You almost get back to the barn, and your bales aren't stacked real tight, so one jiggles off, falls on the ground, and the string breaks. So Dad would throw it up against the barn, and then throw you up against the barn. Right, and he would say, "We'll get that one later. Don't worry about it." So we wouldn't get it later. It would get rained on, and then once straw's been rained on, it's not good anymore. You really can't use it. So we would let it sit there. Eventually, it would get snowed.
Let's clarify that you really can't use it for the purpose for which it was intended.
Right. I don't want to give away the answer.
Yeah, okay, well, that's very good. I'll tell you what. All right. Wrap that up, a story, and then because we've got some callers, and we'll take them.
And then here it would be the following spring when the snow melted, and some great big thistles would start growing out of those straw bales. A couple seeds would fall on the top of the bale, and voila, the biggest, tallest weeds on the whole farm were the ones growing out of these decomposing bales of straw.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we fast forward 15 years, and I've graduated from college and bought my first property, and I found out I had about an inch of topsoil all over my yard, so I wasn't able to vegetable garden in that. And I didn't have any money. Of course, when you first buy a house and you're young, you don't have any money.
You know, and you'd think that a farmer would understand, but you don't, because and this is one of the great scams in American life, is that when you buy a house and it's in a subdivision, they've basically ripped you off. They've taken all the soil away, and they've left you with junk.
Yeah, construction dirt, that's what I call it.
Yeah, right, and then they throw on a couple of inches of topsoil to cover it all up and hide.
Exactly.
Yeah, the biggest scam in America.
Exactly. And so I couldn't afford to bring in a whole bunch of soil and do a major construction, so I thought about the days when I used to see those straw bales up against the barn. I thought, well, you know, ragweeds and thistles grow so well out of those bales, why wouldn't tomatoes? Mm-hmm. So I decided to start doing some testing, and we found out it worked really well. So
and then you realized, I have a book in this, and I can go on tour and make a gazillion dollars.
The thing of it is 20 years ago, I never dreamed in a million years anybody would be interested. And they really weren't for about, you know, I got a few friends and neighbors that did it early on. But it wasn't until 6 years ago that I really, you know, I got on TV. Some guy came and did a thing, and we got done with the TV thing, and everybody was calling the studio asking to get information. And this guy said, the reporter said, you know, you should write a book about this. And I said, I can't write a book. You know, I don't know anything about writing a book. And so I did a little self-published, I call it a booklet, that came out 6 years ago. And then we got on Facebook, and then things just exploded after that.
Wow. How many Facebook?
We had about 30,000 followers on Facebook.
See, now why didn't I find yours?
Pretty close. Learn to grow a straw bale garden.
Okay. Yeah.
I know. I didn't know at the time when I set it up that people would have to type that all in. So.
Right, and that's the problem. Yeah. That's what makes it hard to find those. Okay, Rob, let's do these in the order in which they came in. So we go with, it's straight through. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. I didn't even tell Rob what the answer was, so he might know anyway because he's a gardener. Let's start with Francis. Is that on line one? You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Straw is the residue of a crop, mostly grass crops, whereas hay is the actual forage or feed for the animals.
Okay, Joel's kind of going,
He's got it half right.
Okay, hang on a second. Hang on. We'll see if we can do better than that. Let's go to Jeanette from Chicago, I see. Jeanette, what's your answer?
Good morning. Straw is a bedding and mulching product. Hay is food.
Right.
There you go, Jeanette. And guess what?
Yay.
She's in the city.
Well, bonus points for you.
Yeah, Jeanette. Bonus points for Jeanette.
Thank you.
And you said it very simply. Now, hang on a second. Let's see if I lose you. Don't despair. You're the winner. But let's go to now. Why did it do that? I did lose her. Get Jeanette. Jeanette, call back. Darn this thing. Okay, Ginger. Were you going to say more or less the same thing?
Yes, you grow the. They put the straw in the barn for the animals to lay on, and the hay is to feed the cattle.
Right.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Iowa on a farm, so.
Well, there you go.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you kindly get this, please? Great. You know, unfortunately, Jeanette beat you to the call, and we're going to...
I heard.
But that's okay, but thank you. That's a great answer. And let's go to Elizabeth. Was that more or less in the ballpark for you, too?
Pretty much. I was just going to say the hay is the food, and the straw is once the grain has been stripped off.
Yeah, that's essential, too, Elizabeth. That's a good point, is that it's oats or wheat or barley or... rice. It's a small grain, cereal grain crop, and the seeds have been removed. So all that's left is the stalk portion. That's really essential to the whole process of straw bale gardening. So,
okay. Well, again, Elizabeth, you were just a little short on the draw there, but thank you, and we appreciate you calling in. And we go back to, and I knew I was going to drop you, Jeanette, but you're back.
Yes, I wasn't sure if I needed to stay on hold.
Yeah, because we're going to get your information. We're going to send you a copy of Straw Bale Gardens, the breakthrough method for growing vegetables anywhere earlier, et cetera, et cetera.
I'm so thrilled. I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to have this book.
Why?
I've been wanting to do this for the longest time.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
because I think it's a healthy way to do it. It's a good use of organic material. And from what I've seen and heard, you can get a lot more crop out of your land in a, you know, in a city lot in particular.
Well, that's what we're about to find out. So I will put you on hold, and I'm glad that this is something that you've been excited about. And thank you for calling, and congratulations, and thank you for listening to the show.
I love the show. Thanks so much, Mike.
My pleasure. All right. There's Jeanette. So she got it right, the idea between straw and hay. Explain again in your own words, Joel.
Straw is the cereal grain crops, barley, oats, wheat. The seeds have been removed and, of course, become bread and bread flour and oatmeal and Wheaties, etc. But the stalks that remain behind are kind of a byproduct of the small grain crop. And some farmers just leave them on the field and dig them into the ground as, you know, replenishment for the soil. But some of them bale it up and it becomes bedding material.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you. How do you make that determination if you just happen to have a whole lot of the stuff?
Well, if they've got a market for it, that's what they're really looking for. There's a lot of farmers out in the Dakotas that don't even bother baling the straw because they don't, you know, they got to transport it to market. And who's going to buy, you know, 800,000 straw bales? So they just don't even bother with it. But if they do have a market, which it's starting to grow, maybe because of straw bale gardening and the price of straw has gone up enough, you know, people blame me for that, but the price of straw has gone up enough that it's making it worth their while.
Well, it's also a good organic mulch for
Absolutely.
Gardening. I mean, I've gotten a hold of straw bales, and I use them in my community garden.
Yeah, a lot of people.
And even after it gets wet in a community garden, you can still break it apart and spread it on because it dries out again and it doesn't get nasty, you know. But if it's in a bale and it's wet, then it's nasty.
Well, it starts to get nasty very quick, which for us is exactly what we're looking for.
Exactly. So you don't just leave it to chance, though, from reading your book. You actually have a whole method and you walk people through, what is it, 12 days?
12 days, yep. If you're doing it organically, it can take 18, you know, 20 days.
And that's the interesting thing, too, that you know, you, okay, I don't want to be, say the, give you, use a pejorative, but it's almost like you go, oh, and you organic types out there, if you want to know.
I do over half my bales now I do completely organically. It's just expensive. You know, it's a much more expensive route to go because of the materials. For to get enough nitrogen from organic sources in order to do the decomposition takes about six times the volume.
That's the point. If you buy an organic fertilizer, the nitrogen levels, all of the levels of the NPK are much lower by volume than the synthetics.
Right.
So that means that you don't have a problem with synthetics in your straw bales.
I know, I really don't. You know, if people are into, you know, doing it that way, they certainly can. It's much less expensive if they use lawn fertilizer, which, you know, you can get a 30-40 pound bag of lawn fertilizer.
I mean, that's the other thing. You're talking about using lawn fertilizer. You're also talking about using one of my great sponsors, Milorganite.
Sure.
You obviously think that's a great way to go.
Yeah, I put them in my book as well. I think it's a great product, and it, you know, if you want to stay organic, it's certified organic, so it's a great fertilizer to use.
OMRI.
Yeah.
And all right. So I know you don't want to give away the exact method because, well, and besides, if you pick up the book, you get a lot of extra tips. You know, he's not going to be able to do this in 20 minutes here on the radio show. But give me a rough idea of how people start doing this.
Well, get yourself a couple of straw bales. You know, you can start with one if you don't have space, but it's nice to start with four or five because you can do a variety of different crops and really see some the way different things perform. So get some straw bales. You're just going to set them up. I like to set mine up just in a straight row, mainly so I can make a trellis above the straw bales. And we show you how to do that in the book using some fence posts and wire it across the fence post. You're going to put on whichever fertilizer source you want to use, organic or traditional, basically every other day for a period of 12 days. And you're going to water the bales every day. So you're going to water them days 1 through 12, keep them wet. That's really important because that bacteria inside is really what we're counting on to do the decomposition of the bale. So we're not going to plant in 12 days. We're not going to plant into straw. We're going to plant into very early stage compost or soil because the bales are going to decompose very quickly.
And once again, and I talk about this on my show, and I know some people's eyes glaze over when I do, but it's the soil food web. It's how it's what compost is when the organic materials start to break down, right, and you have the biology in there.
Right.
And what you're talking about is encouraging the biology.
Absolutely.
A straw bale.
Truly, it's bacteria that does the majority of the work of decomposition in Mother Nature. Bacteria, there's also worms, there's also some insects.
Do you get worms in a straw bale?
Your bales, amazingly, they fill up with worms. Even if you put this bale in your parking lot, it's still going to fill
up. Where do they come from?
It's still going to get worms inside of it. And fungi as well, mushrooms, will grow on the outside. So,
hey, but that's not harmful.
No, not at all. Not at all. I just tell people, leave them alone, plant around them. If they start pushing your seeds out of the bale, then you need to kind of squish them down a little bit. But usually they go away within a couple of weeks. It's actually a good sign when you see mushrooms coming up because it means decomposition is happening.
So you set this up for 12 days, and what you're doing is getting the decomposition going. And as you say, the two key elements are fertilizer and water. And, and then at that point, what happens?
At that point, you're going to plant. Day 12, if you used lawn fertilizer, day probably 18 or so, if you're doing it organically, you're using something like blood meal to do your decomposition. Just takes a little bit longer because, it's organic. It has to break down the source of nitrogen before mm-hmm. the nitrogen can become available to the bacteria. So you get to that point and you'll see something really interesting happens is that the bales heat up. They get really hot inside. So for us northern gardeners up here in the tundra, especially where I'm over in Minnesota.
The tundra is melting, my friend. Soon we'll be releasing all kinds of methane.
But it really is nice to be able to plant a tomato into a straw bale that's 100 degrees, whereas the soil right next to the straw bale is only 50 degrees at May 15th.
That's the part where I think people can get excited about this, because you're getting a head start.
Big time head start. Really fast early season root production, which means typically a shorter season by about 10% for that crop,
mm-hmm.
Which over where I'm in Minnesota, sometimes you go out in late September, early October, and your tomatoes are frozen solid hanging on the vine because you got an overnight frost and they're all green still. So mm-hmm. your tomatoes don't have a chance to get ripe. Using this method, you're going to get ripe tomatoes earlier in the season. It's pretty much standard.
So it's not so much that you can extend the season as that you just get it supercharged earlier.
Right. When they put days to maturity on a plant, on a vegetable plant, it's based on planting in 50 degree soil on May 15th and, et cetera. So mm-hmm. this is planting in 100 degree soil. So it makes a really big difference.
It doesn't harm the plants at all? I mean, can you get a bale too hot?
Oh, it will be really hot during that first 2 week process while it's decomposing. But usually by the end of 12 days or so, it's started already to cool down. So you'll see mm-hmm. the bales get up 150 degrees. You won't want to plant in that bale when it's that hot during that 2 week.
Not even
process.
Around the edges.
No. Well, you probably could get by, but I just don't advise it. I mm-hmm. say wait until the middle of the bale has cooled off below 100 degrees, and then you can go ahead and plant.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that's about right at 2 weeks. That's why the timing is kind of important and the mounts you put on are important. Eventually, any bale left outside up against the barn, 25 years ago, the bale will decompose eventually on its own. You're sucking nitrogen basically out of the soil that it's sitting on, it will use that as a source for food for the bacteria and decompose mm-hmm. that bale. But it just takes a lot longer, and you don't know exactly when it's going to be ready. If you follow my process, you'll know exactly the date you should be planting.
And it's all in the book. Straw bale gardens, straw bale gardens, the breakthrough method for growing vegetables anywhere earlier and with no weeding. Let's get to that. I am going to take a short break here, but 773-763-9278 is our phone number. If you got any questions for Joel Karsten about his straw bale gardening method, 773-763-9278. We've got some time. We'll be happy to entertain a couple of questions. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. The first line of defense against pest and disease problems is plant health. The healthier a tree or shrub or any plant for that matter, the better able it will be to fend off pests and diseases. Before pest problems occur, the Care of Trees can restore your tree's natural health with state-of-the-art, environmentally friendly approaches, like their soil care program. It doesn't exactly restore your tree's natural surroundings to the way Mother Nature set it up, but it comes pretty darn close. Contact the Care of Trees today to set up an appointment with one of their certified arborists. They will inspect your property and have an arborist develop a soil care program that specifically meets the needs of your property and your trees. Hey, who knows? Maybe they'll bring in some straw and get it to decompose because it is feeding your soil. To contact a certified arborist at the Care of Trees about their soil care program, call 800-508-9466 for a free consultation. 800-508-9466. Call today, and they will call you back tomorrow. Or go to thecareoftrees.com. The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545. Or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. In the studio with me right now is Joel Karsten, the author of Straw Bale Gardens. And I got a tweet here, Joel, from My Skinny Garden, who writes, I was thinking of doing this in my big veggie garden space where I just excavated all the old raised beds. Can I do this now? Is this the wrong season for this?
Well, you know, it's a little late for most of our vegetable crops. We're not going to have enough time to get crops mature at this point in the season. But you certainly could start looking for bales and getting them ready to go for next spring. You know, we don't start the conditioning process until the spring, but I'll tell you, it's harder to find straw bales in the spring than it is in the fall.
Yeah.
So as we're coming into the August here in the fall, you're going to see straw bales for sale at a lot of garden centers, places like that, nurseries. Because people buy them for fall decoration and for all the uses, insulation and whatnot that people use straw bales for, mm-hmm. in their mulch in their garden, that kind of stuff. So find them this fall, put them out in your garden, let them get snowed on and rained on. It won't hurt them at all.
Oh, really? So you're not saying protect them over the winter and then get to the moisture later?
Nope. I say just put them out there. They'll start conditioning a little bit, but just put them so the strings don't touch the
ground. You don't want to fertilize them early.
Nope, don't fertilize them.
Until the spring.
Until the spring. And then they'll heat up. As soon as you put that fertilizer on, bam, they're going to get hot. Mm-hmm. The next day, usually, they've warmed up significantly, but even in one day.
And you even have a link in the book website for tracking down straw, which is www.strawbalemarket.com.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. It's a site we started basically so we could connect growers, farmers, essentially, directly to consumers. So, you know, if you're going to buy 5 bales or 3 bales, run down to your garden center and, you know, give them whatever they ask for it. That's not a problem. But if you're going to do 50 or 100 bales, we have a lady in Tennessee that has 2,000 bales.
Pokey smoke.
Yeah. You're going to want to find a direct from the source supplier, so you can get a better better price on that larger quantities.
And among the benefits of this, obviously, it's as we've mentioned in an urban area, slam it on a asphalt parking lot or bad soil, or you've got lead in the soil. You say just put fabric under the bale.
Yep.
And then that's what we would do anyway. If you had, if you were putting soil on top of bad soil, you would have fabric, a fabric barrier between your fresh soil and the contaminated soil anyway.
Right. And it keeps those roots from growing down into the contaminated.
That's true, because that could possibly happen. Yeah. So I can understand why you might not have weeds because you're sitting up 2 feet. But don't weed seeds still blow in?
You know, you'll get seeds that will blow in over the period of a year, but usually those seeds are inert until the following cycle. They have to winter cycle. Most seeds have to have some kind of what we call scarification in order to make that seed decide to germinate and grow. And usually that means they have to overwinter one winter.
So they whereas they can overwinter on soil and the soil will be there next year, the following year, you've replaced your straw bale.
Essentially, yeah. We're making brand new soil every spring. One of the biggest advantages of straw bale gardening is you get virgin soil every spring, so you don't have to deal with those lingering disease and insect problems.
And crop rotation.
And crop rotation is out the window. You don't have to worry about that because crop rotation is essential to try to alleviate the problems with insects and disease that accumulate over time in the soil year after year. So in straw bale gardening, we're starting with a fresh bale every spring, making our own virgin soil. Now, you can actually get 2 years out of a bale. If you buy big, heavy, well-compressed, compacted bales, and at the end of the season, they're still holding their shape pretty well, go ahead and use them.
And that's kind of the determining factor, isn't it? It's got to hold its shape.
Right. You know, if they just fall over, then it's like gardening in a little compost pile, which is essentially what the bales turn into after a period of time, is they turn into a little pile of beautiful compost that, that you can use for all kinds of things in your garden. To enhance existing soil or mulch around your perennials.
That's the great thing is that nothing gets wasted.
Right. Yeah, it's a completely sustainable process. You know, you if you're using straw harvested from small grain crops, you know, it's a replenishable product and you don't have to worry about, you know, using something up.
Now, you talk about weeds and diseases. What about insects? I mean, can't insects pretty much go anywhere?
Your flying insects certainly are probably attracted by scent. I mean, you know, if you get into the mind of an insect, probably they've learned.
And I do often. I try to meld with it.
They're either attracted by scent to what their destination is, or they're a beetle crawling along the ground and they bump into the stem of a cauliflower plant and they crawl up on top, you know, because they know there's food up there. Whereas now they're going to bump into the side of a straw bale. So it just disorients them a little bit.
Yeah, I would think so.
And they don't know to climb up the straw bale to get to their source of food. So
your cabbage butterfly will still find
it. Yeah. And, you know, we still do have some problems, but you'll see there are much fewer problems. I mean, I use virtually no pesticides at all in my garden. You know, Japanese beetles still come around, but I always figure if your plants are growing fast enough, you can afford to give up a little bit to the Japanese beetle and still get a nice crop. So I have more problems with a rabbit in my neighborhood, a couple of mama rabbits in my neighborhood than I do with anything else. But
well, what do you do about a rabbit? Is it still fencing the answer?
Exactly. Yeah. I also like the scarecrow sprinklers, you know, the motion sensor sprinklers.
Sure,
those seem to work pretty good. But if you've got a persistent rabbit, she's gonna get to your crops anyway. So and people always ask me, will they jump up on a straw bale? Yes, they absolutely will. They'll still lean up on the edges or they'll jump up on top and they'll still, you know, go after your garden. So if you have rabbits, you probably want to put a netting or fencing around it.
Yeah, there's some I go into garden clubs and do talks and people ask me all the time about certain questions, and my answer for rabbits and critters is those are difficult questions. They affect everything, every time. If they were not difficult, would these questions come up at every single garden talk that you've ever been to? So if there were a magic bullet for rabbits and deer and those kinds of things, somebody would have figured it out a long time ago.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming in. I'm glad that you were able to spend a couple extra days around the Chicago area. Where are you off to next?
Back to Minneapolis.
You just, you know, now that you're a big-time star,
big-time
star. He's going to be throwing rocks into Iowa, you know.
Yeah, right. I'm going to go down to the farm and help my dad for a couple days.
Oh, well, there you go. Still, he still drags you into that, huh?
Oh, yeah.
And probably, you know, baling straw, right? And throwing throwing bales around?
Probably not that at this point. But
okay. Do you have some, 20-year-olds to help you with that?
Yeah, high school kids. That's
Get
that's
the high school kids that's to right. do it, you know, to mow the lawn and throw the straw bales. It's called Straw Bale Gardens. It's written by Joel Karsten. The publisher is Cool Springs Press. You can get it probably just about anywhere. I've linked on my website. If you want more information about the book and about Joel, go to MikeNovak.net. Go to This Week's Show. I've got the link right there. And, of course, I always take it to the person's website, you know. No Amazon. No Amazon for me, baby.
I
don't want
that,
them
Mike.
Sucking off your the money and the residuals for this. So, thanks again. And
thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And I hope we get to do this again sometime.
Indeed. That would be wonderful. Hopefully our paths will cross.
I think they will. They probably will indeed. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Rick DeMaio weather coming up next.
Make this your best gardening season yet. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Invest a bit of time now to ensure a bountiful harvest and beautiful landscape throughout the season. And let Milorganite, an eco-friendly, all-purpose fertilizer, help you accomplish your gardening goals. Start by adding several inches of organic matter to the top 6 to 12 inches of soil. Peat moss, compost, and other organic materials improve drainage in heavy clay soil and increase the water-holding ability of sandy soils. Incorporate Milorganite organic nitrogen fertilizer into all your planting beds. The low nitrogen formula makes it goof-proof so you won't harm young, tender plants. The slow-release formula provides small amounts of fertilizer over time, encouraging overall growth without preventing flowering and fruiting. And properly prepared soil will help your plantings better survive the heat, drought, and pest attacks of summer. So choose Milorganite for better results naturally. Visit Milorganite.com to find a store near you.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine dedicated to healthy and sustainable living. Natural Awakenings is available monthly, and we provide the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings also talks about local sustainability, gardening and environment, energy conservation, and green living. We feature local news and a calendar to help you stay connected. I can guarantee that each month you'll discover a new health tip, a tasty recipe, a service in your neighborhood, something that makes your life better. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Want to make a positive move in the housing market? Replace your siding and windows. You'll improve your home's look and energy efficiency, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling and energy needs. Siding, windows, solar and wind power, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
It's the Mike Novak Show on a beautiful, beautiful Sunday morning in Chicago. This is what you consider real summer weather. And by the way, Rob, I know you would probably be interested in this. So I've read the book. If you want a copy of it and take a look at it and maybe discuss it with your fellow community gardeners.
Master gardener and community gardener friends.
Yeah, sure. I think, it was funny that we had the master gardener meeting at your,
The Monarch Garden.
The Monarch Garden a couple of weeks ago. And quite unprompted, one of the master gardeners said, "Hey, you got to get a hold of this book. It's called Straw Bale Gardens." And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to be talking to the author in a couple of weeks on the show." So
it's getting out there. And as Joel mentioned, a lot of other people are doing this as well. Oh, you know what? I meant to find his. Do you remember what the name of his Facebook?
Yeah.
What?
I posted it.
Because I wanted to go there and like it.
Learn to grow a straw bale garden.
Okay, great.
That's the Facebook.
Wow, that's a long title. Learn to grow a straw bale garden. Survey says. Maybe it'll show up. And I had other people who wrote in and said they had answered the question. You get the, there's the Facebook page. There it is. 27,000 likes. Now, how do we make that work for this show? How to grow a radio garden? Something like that? Do you think we can get 27,000 likes?
Something like that.
I'm trying to crack a grand here. Feel free to like me, anybody out there. I meant on Facebook. You can like me as a person as well. I like Rick DeMaio, and he's on the line right now. Rick, good morning.
Good morning, and I guess, why don't you say, Mike, like, do you like this weather? Maybe that'll help people like you on Facebook.
Do you like this weather, folks? Like me on Facebook if you want to get more of it, because Rick will deliver.
Yeah, but the problem, though, is, the weekends that we have nasty weather, they'll unlike you. Can I actually do that?
Well, I got to tell you, it does happen. I'll get, with me, with Facebook and Twitter, it's a roller coaster. I get likes and then they leave me and then they unlike me and then you just move forward.
Welcome to my world when, you walk in someplace and they go, are you to blame for this? I go, yeah, I am. It's just standard. I think people find it easiest to talk to a weather person, more than any profession, because they can relate to exactly what's going on outside. They go, did you deliver this? I go, yeah, I did.
And so you're also, you're among the most maligned occupation, I think, in the whole world.
Yeah, we are. You have to have thick skin. And I always tell people, if you're getting into this business, particularly the aviation side, and that's pretty much where I'm heading for the next 5 days in Kansas City. If you are not humbled at least once a week, that means that you're not trying hard enough. And it's true, because the only way you're going to get better is to get humbled, and every once in a while.
I get humbled on this show all the time, believe me.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I do.
But I'm actually heading down to Kansas City, Missouri. I'm going to the Aviation Weather Center. A lot of people don't realize it, but the National Weather Service has five main centers. The one that I think everybody is familiar with, actually the first two, are the National Hurricane Center down in Miami, Florida, the Storm Prediction Center in Norman, Oklahoma. And then you have the main one, which I think is probably the one that is, the busiest 24/7, is the Aviation Weather Center in Kansas City. And then you have the other two, which is the Climate Prediction Center, and basically the National Center for Environmental Prediction. That's where they have all the main, computers. But this particular facility is really a sight to see. It looks like an enormous warehouse, futuristic factory that you'd see somewhere on the outskirts of Washington, D.C. And the great thing about it is we'll be there. I'll be there with about 30 or 40 other people for the next 5 days, just basically looking at weather patterns in the morning, get there at about 7:30 in the morning. We go through our forecast. We figure out how to make the traffic, the air traffic, flow better across the United States. And then you come back a little bit later in the afternoon. You see how things work out. And you look at all the different products that they're putting out there for pilots and air traffic controllers and dispatchers to use. And we're constantly seeing how to make things better. I was there last year, and I'll be there this year for about 5 days, and it's really an amazing experience. It really is something to see.
And it sounds like weathercaster nirvana.
Yeah, and the thing about it is you're basically pitting your talents against everybody else. And from someone who was in the operational environment with United Airlines for about 12 years, and kind of forayed into TV for a while and kind of dabble in that and then get back into the academic world, you kind of see things from different perspectives. But, you're trying to make, forecasts that are very, very difficult, very easy to use for air traffic controllers, say, in the New York City area that have to handle traffic for Newark and LaGuardia and Kennedy. And they basically need to know at what point will this corridor shut down? Because I have 50 airplanes coming through it over the next hour and a half, and that's a tough call. So it's our job to make their job easier. And the great thing about being from the Chicago area, you know, obviously I'm familiar with O'Hare Airport and Midway, and I grew up in the New York area. So as O'Hare goes, so goes the rest of the United States. And that usually is the same case for the New York City area as well. So we get to talk not only aviation weather, but it's amazing when you get all these, when you said meteorological nirvana, people are always talking about, you know, the climate. This past rainy season, the last time I was out in Kansas City, it was basically brown and yellow. There was no rain. Now they've had nothing but rain and extreme flooding across, you know, the central part of Kansas and the southern Missouri. You've heard about, you know, almost a foot of rain in the last week down there. And it is about as 180 degree shift this summer compared to last summer. So far, only 6 days above 90. Last year, we had almost 40. Even though we're about a couple of degrees below normal temperature-wise, I would take this over the 7 degrees above normal. We're actually almost 10 degrees cooler this summer, Mike, than we were last year. And that's the case pretty much across much of the Midwest right now.
Yeah, but, you know, that I was seeing the other day watching Mr. Skilling, and he was saying, while we're 7 degrees cooler from last summer, that on average it's less than a degree cooler than it normally is.
Right. Less than a degree. That's only because last year was so, you know, was so darn hot, and particularly across, you know, the middle part of the country. And it's interesting because, you know, the AMS, the American Meteorological Society, just published their, you know, state of the climate for 2012. And, you know, when you look at this, you have to make sure that, you know, you're not looking at it with a slanted eye. You have to be a scientist. You have to look at it very objectively. And I think that's what the AMS did as well. And they have, you know, over 500, you know, scientists look at this. So, you know, when people refute these, you know, diagnostics of the climate, you got to realize this is put together by people who are just basically doing science. So some of the bullet points, which I think are kind of interesting, the year 2012 for the lower 48 went down as the warmest on record. Temperatures globally, even though they weren't the warmest on record, they were in the top 10, which is still pretty significant. Arctic sea ice last year actually reached a record low, and this year was on schedule to reach another record low. But kind of a couple of strange things have happened. That the sea ice in the Arctic actually expanded a little bit in coverage over the last couple of weeks, and that's not because it got colder. We've actually had record warmth or near record warmth across parts of the Arctic and into Canada, and the reason why that sea ice is actually spread out was because it's been so warm in that part of the globe, you know, between 60 and 80 degrees north. We've had an unusual number of a high number of storms actually move through that area that you would not typically get. And the wind flow actually broke the ice up. So and I make this point, Mike, because when you might hear on other competing radio stations, mainly to the right, go, oh, but did you hear the Arctic's colder? The sea ice is now expanded. So these people don't know what they're talking about. There's a reason why the sea ice has expanded, is that we've had some storms that have gone through that area that has actually broken the ice up and has kind of pushed it through a larger area. So you got to be really careful about looking at some of these numbers. In the last minute that we have here, sea levels continue to rise. They're at record height across all the globe. Interestingly enough, tropical cyclones are actually near average. And after 2 years of basically no change, all the man-made gases have actually gone up a little bit, mainly due to the fact that the economy globally has begun to uptick a little bit and there's a little bit more production. So there's always a bunch of reasons why some of these numbers come out the way they do.
Mm-hmm. I do have to say, I was on the tour yesterday for the Southeast Environmental Task Force. They're down in the dumps tour, which is really fascinating, going to the southeast side and seeing the degradation that's occurred over, you know, basically a century right. of misuse, and how it's they're trying to help it rebound. But tangentially, there was a woman on the bus who's a huge fan of you, Mr. DeMaio. And she says, you have to, she just said, well, I love Rick. And I, you know, and the folks who listen to the show, I know they love you. And she said the thing that you know, that you were just doing, which is explaining why these things happen. And very quickly, we do have a couple minutes, but are those storms the reason? I understand there's a pressure area north of us that's kept us cool all
right.
And is that also have something to do with what's going on in the Arctic?
Yeah, absolutely. You've basically taken this huge bubble of warm air and pushed it over Western Canada up into Alaska, and has forced the storm track up into, say, you know, between the Arctic Circle and the North Pole. And when you have all this wind spread the ice out, you actually get more ice extent. That doesn't mean that it's cooling. It just means that the ice has broken up a little bit. So hopefully that'll help people understand those numbers. So bottom line, great looking day today. Second week in a row with absolutely fantastic weather. 80 today, storms tomorrow.
Storms tomorrow when?
Probably late in the afternoon.
It's
going to be a fairly significant rain and cooler the rest of the week. So the rest of the week looks like temperatures in the 70s.
I say that because I'm golfing in a tournament tomorrow. So
I would just hold up that lightning rod and you'll be a nice assistant. How about that?
You mean that's what I got to worry about too?
Yikes. Yeah, I'm sure. You always have to.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't have come up with a more perfect day today. I walked outside and went, holy smoke. This is what summer's all about.
This is exactly. You got to enjoy it because in a month or two from now, we'll be gone. I wish I had that day back.
Yeah, we will. Rick DeMaio, we'll talk again next week. Thank you so much, buddy.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Coming up in the second hour, that conversation about bees, get your phone calls ready. Call in at 773-763-9278. You can tweet to us. You can follow us on Facebook. Shoot us a question on Facebook as well. Dr. May Barenbaum is going to be here, Jeffrey Pettis, Zach Browning, Dr. Mark Whalen, and they're going to be talking about what everybody's talking about, which is insecticides and bee loss. How are they connected? Is it just that? There are studies showing that there are other elements involved in this, and I want to get the straight skinny from the people who know. And so we will be doing that. In the second hour, also want to let you know that, of course, towards the end of the second hour, Jordan Parker from Bring Your Bag Chicago will be here, and we will talk about that effort in the city of Chicago, because it's not done. It's still happening to rid us of the scourge of plastic bags. So it's the Mike Novak Show, and I hope you stick around for the second hour.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. Here he is again, Mike Novak. I've been hanging around.
I've been hanging around his radio station for about 5 years. So far, so good. And I'm very happy to say I have in the studio with me Dr. May R. Barenbaum, who is the department head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It's great to have you back on the show.
Always a pleasure to be here.
It's been a while, though, since you were on, I think. And I don't think you've been here in person.
I think it might have been a different radio station.
Well, it was in a different location.
A different location.
Yeah. Because, you know, and maybe it was a different radio station. It's been that long.
Yeah.
Rob, are you having issues here tracking down Jeff?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, you got two numbers. You've tried both of them, right? We've got a cell number and the landline. You've tried both? You're working? Oh, he's getting to it. Okay. Just want to make sure. I know. Because we've got lots of guests here on the show. And I'm impressed by me, May.
May I call you May, by the way?
Please, absolutely.
You, by the way, you have the best email address ever, ever. If you write to Dr. May R. Barenbaum, her email address is M-A-Y-B-E, maybe.
First five letters of my name.
At so. Whatever, blah, 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 you know. But I love it. But that's maybe. I love it. I want that email address. So the last time you and I, I was going to say I was impressed myself because you said, I said, what are you doing in Chicago? And she said, I'm being on your show. So you drove all the way or came up, I don't know if you took the train, whatever, but you came all the way up here to be on the radio program.
Yep.
Wow. Where's my bell? All right. It's such a pleasure to have you here. The last time you and I saw each other in person was at a seminar about bees, mm-hmm. in McHenry County. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had some interesting conversations there. I just enjoyed talking to you so much. And that was just about the time that colony collapse disorder became a phrase that was being bandied about.
And public awareness finally, embraced the problem.
Well, you know, the scientists had embraced it at that point, but and researchers, I'm not so sure about the public, but the public has caught on.
Mm-hmm.
And now people ask about it. Before we get going in our conversation, I want to go to line three and bring in Jeff Pettis, who's a research leader in bee research at the USDA Agricultural Research Center in Beltsville, Maryland. Jeff, are you with me?
Yes, I am. Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you again. I interviewed the two of you. I did a story on CCD, I want to say 6 years ago, you know, for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. I talked to both of you, and at the time, I said, so what's wrong? Why are bees disappearing? Well, and everybody does, you know, the lay people come in and say, so what's going on? And at the time, you guys said, well, it's complicated. We really don't know, and it's complicated. Dr. Barenbaum, would you say the same thing today?
Yeah, I think so. I know the public is clamoring for a single satisfying explanation, but there is no scientific basis for identifying a single satisfying.
All right, you're going to throw science out here, and people are going to get upset.
Yep.
Because they do. And I'll tell you right now, I wrote about it on my website, MikeNovak.net. If you go to this week's show, and I tried to encapsulate everything that's been going on, but I mean, you could write a book about it right now, and I'm just a radio guy. But one of the things I have noticed is that there are people who've decided to skip the science. Okay, and those are the and I'm going to make some environmentalists angry here because they have decided they know what's causing it, and it's neonicotinoids, which is a kind of pesticide that has been used roughly for about 10 years and it's been and rapidly become the most popular pesticide in the world or a group of pesticides in the world. And yet, Dr. Barenbaum, you would say hold your horses, I would imagine.
Well, evidence began to accumulate, starting about 2010, there was a study, well, actually 2009, a study actually examining what pesticides bees are encountering. And shockingly, the number of pesticide detections in bees and in hives and hive products is astonishing. Over 121 different pesticides and metabolites have been documented. Dr. Pettis is more, he's been involved in these studies directly, but what these studies have shown repeatedly is that the neonicotinoids are part of what appears to be a very toxic mix. So isolating one component of a complex melange is not necessarily going to establish a cause-effect relationship. And in fact, neonics, in terms of contaminants, are difficult to document. And the number one most frequently encountered contaminants in many of these studies have been the pesticides that the beekeepers themselves put into the colony to kill the parasitic mites, the varroa mites. And a lot of problems associated with bees and beekeeping can be linked to these mites.
So you're saying that the beekeepers themselves are contributing to the problem, possibly?
Not really. I'm just saying that there is certainly, if you're going to indict a particular pesticide, if you look just objectively at what's in the hives, not surprisingly, what's in the hives includes what beekeepers put in the hives. And you can't really blame them because these there are very few alternative pesticides that have been approved for use in hive against honeybees. It's very difficult to design a pesticide that will kill the parasitic mites without harming the honeybees, because bees and mites are both they're fairly closely related. They belong to the phylum Arthropoda. They are both arthropods. Most pesticides are designed to kill insects and spare vertebrates. But when you really narrow down the target and you're trying to differentiate between two closer relatives, that makes it difficult. Moreover, the mites evolve very quickly. They are now resistant to the two approved pesticides, historically approved pesticides, taufivalinate and Coumaphos. And the EPA just recently approved use of an older acaricide, a mite-killing compound, Ametraz. But there are not many weapons in the arsenals that beekeepers can use to control varroa mites. And varroa mites are important because they suppress the immune system of the honeybee, and they are also carriers or vectors of many of the viral diseases that Dr. Pettis and others have documented clearly are afflicting America's honeybees.
That's May R. Barenbaum, Dr. May R. Barenbaum from University of Illinois. I also have on the line Jeffrey Pettis from the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Beltsville, Maryland. And still on hold is Zach Browning. Zach, I know you're listening. I'll get to you in a second. But I want to go to Dr. Pettis, because you were involved in a study that got released recently and brought up something that nobody was talking about until recently, which is fungicides. Can you tell me a little bit about this study that you did with the University of Maryland?
Sure. Before I go there, I'll just quickly say that Dr. Barenbaum is correct, that things that beekeepers use to control parasitic mites are one of the things we're finding in hives. It's a case of damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you don't control varroa, you don't have a hive that's alive. And if you use some of the products, then you end up with residues in wax. And as she pointed out, we have a complex mix of things within the hive. And yeah, this most recent study, we looked at, I think, 10 different crops, and we trapped the pollen coming into the door, the front door of those hives. And the surprising part was that the fungicides coming in on pollen were causing adverse effects. They were causing an interaction between a parasite that infects the gut. Nosema is the name. It's a gut-infecting parasite. When they fed on the pollen that contained the fungicides, then they were more susceptible to this one particular pathogen, Nosema. So fungicides weren't necessarily on people's radar that much, and this study just highlights the complexity of bee health somewhat, and also that in most environments, there are things out there that could harm bees, and in this case, fungicides were pointed out.
By the way, I have to throw this in, Jeff. I just got a tweet from one of my listeners who writes, "Go Beltsville, Maryland, and Jeff!" She's out your way, so and she's listening to the show, so she appreciates.
Thanks, Mom.
No, it's not Mom. So you've got fans out there. All right, you know, it's what we're getting to is the question I started with, which is it's very complex. However,
people hate that answer. They hate that bee health is complex, but it's this huge superorganism sampling of, you know, 5 square mile radius or something. I mean, it's just they're sampling the environment. There's all these interactions in the hive, and there's multiple things going on at one time. So yeah, it is complex.
But something that you said to me, Dr. Barenbaum, 7 years ago, has stayed with me, and I don't know whether I misinterpreted it, but I want to make sure I understand this. At that time, and perhaps I misunderstood, you said something about the bees' genes, a couple of things. One is that they had, as I recall, half of the genes necessary to repel or to deal with these kinds of products? What's that all about?
Okay, in October 2006, the honeybee genome was fully sequenced and published. That's every gene that goes into making up a honeybee. There are two big surprises that came out of the Honeybee Genome Project. One was that honeybees have far fewer genes for detoxifying poisons than other insects. So
why do you think that is?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Other big surprise is they have far fewer genes for dealing with diseases, immunity genes. And that raised the question, why do bees have this astonishing deficit in protecting themselves against environmental threats? Well, one reason is Dr. Pettis alluded to, that bees are not like most other, they're certainly not like most other insects, and they're not like many other organisms because they have this very sophisticated social behavior. A colony of bees is actually a superorganism. It isn't just a community with bees. You can't really compare a colony of honeybees to, say, the city of Chicago or, I don't know, Rosemont, smaller cities, have 30 to 50,000 individuals. They're all related, and they all work together altruistically. So this ability to deal with problems by cooperating with your relatives may have been a contributing factor to, for example, the loss of immunity genes. Honeybees have the capacity to deal with an infection by raising their hive temperature, just like our bodies deal with an infection by developing a fever, raising the temperature. They have a colony-level fever. They all act together to generate heat and raise the temperature, and that actually kills pathogens. They collect resins from trees around the hive that have antimicrobial properties. So collectively, they produce this material called propolis, which is derived from tree resins, which kills microbes. In terms of the pesticides, there are two possible answers. One is that they have evolved historically in the context of a very chemically benign environment. They are pollinators. They're mutualist partners with plants. So plants produce nectar for the sole purpose of rewarding a pollinator. No poisons for the most part. There are some toxic materials, but in terms of plants, plant tissues, nectar is about the safest thing you can eat. Pollen, too. These are rewards for pollinators. Plants fill up their leaves with all kinds of poisons. If you smoke tobacco, you know that. If you drink coffee, you know that. You're dealing with a neurotoxin called caffeine. But pollinators, mutualists, live in a much more chemically beneficent environment. So historically, they've not had chemical challenges like the ones they're now facing in this modern agricultural ecosystem that they function in, where they're introduced in many different ways to synthetic organic pesticides that humans put into the environment, including not just insecticides, but fungicides. The other aspect of why they may have fewer detoxification genes is they may also collectively use behavior to deal with these poisons. For example, people know bees use nectar to make honey. They may not know, they use pollen. They don't eat raw pollen for the most part. They process it into a food that is called bee bread. It's kind of a mix of nectar, of honey and pollen that's fermented, actually. So this process of processing the honey, injecting enzymes, making some biochemical conversions, and then storing it, dehydrating it, reducing the water content from about 90% to 18%, and then letting it sit in the hive at 95 degrees for 4 or 5 days, all of this processing helps reduce the toxin level. The same thing with bee breads is fermentation, just like we pickle things to preserve them, may reduce the toxin. So behaviorally, they have developed mechanisms for processing natural toxins.
But it
synthetic
sounds...
Synthetic toxins are a little more challenging.
Okay, and that's the point. These are synthetic toxins. And something else you said 7 years ago, and I'm glad I didn't get the first thing wrong, because I did remember it correctly.
Yep, you did.
The other thing you said is nothing in the history of the development of bees has prepared them for organophosphates or neonicotinoids and the other chemicals we've put out there.
Absolutely. And everything together. And the chlorothalonil, the fungicide that Dr. Pettis and his colleagues found, this is very, very old-style chemistry with using carbon chlorine bonds. This is typical of the structure of chemicals like DDT and methoxychlorine and other really, you know, old style chemistry. And this carbon.
Is that old style in a good way or a bad way?
No. These were the bad guys. This is what led to, you know, Silent Spring and EPA. And these are incredibly environmentally persistent. And one reason they're persistent is that carbon chlorine bond is very hard for organisms to break down because in the terrestrial world, you don't see that bond very often. We humans can create it in the laboratory, but other than in marine environments where there's a lot of chlorine floating around because salt water is sodium chloride, terrestrial organisms don't process that very well. So it's not at all surprising that there are non-target impacts of these fungicides.
That's Dr. May Barenbaum from University of Illinois. At this point, I want to bring in Zach Browning and Ted, who's got a question from Melrose Park. Hang on, we're going to get to you in just a second, but let me introduce Zach Browning to the conversation. He's a fourth-generation commercial beekeeper and honey producer out of North Dakota. With his brothers, operates over 20,000 hives for honey production. I talked to one of your guys the other day, Zach, and he said, well, maybe it's down to 19,000. Something like that. Go ahead.
Hard to keep tabs sometimes.
Well, you know, that's a lot of hives.
Yeah, we don't do inventory every day. I'll tell you what, it is a challenge, and I do want to report there's some progress here because the answer that we're getting when we're asked what's going on with the bees has moved from, well, it's a mystery, to at least now it's complex. And we know there's a lot of factors involved, but complex is a better word than mystery. What it really comes down to is stress and how much can the organism endure, and where is that stress coming from? Well, I think, you know, Dr. Pettis and Dr. Barenbaum have already touched on a lot of it. The honeybees are stressed performing their roles as pollinators, and when they're not pollinating, they're kind of like orphan tenants of rural America, and rural America usually still means agricultural systems that are in many ways toxic soups. And bees really are dealing with three major stressors. Pesticide exposure is one of those, not necessarily the prominent one, but it is definitely one of those. Varroa and the host of pathogens that are vectored in by the varroa mite are another factor. And one we really haven't touched on today is habitat loss.
Yes.
And you know, honeybees are not unlike many of the other organisms out there. They have to derive their nutrition from the environment. If they're required to find only crops that are either GMO crops or pesticide-treated crops as food sources, then they're not only exposed to those areas when they're treated, but they're also potentially getting a cocktail of poison in the pollen and nectar that is exuded by those plants. And not to mention the fact that the GMO crops in particular, because they are treated with herbicide so frequently and so thoroughly, are really devoid of any other potential diversity. And so there's just not enough flowers. And so sometimes it comes down to the simple situation that we all kind of dismiss. And, you know, bees need flowers not just to make honey, but to get their food. And that's really what makes healthy bees. And if you have a healthy bee, then it might have the ability to metabolize or absorb more pesticide. It might also have a healthier immune system, more fat bodies that would help it to survive through the winter, and all of those critical components for good health.
Well, you know, you mentioned the loss of habitat. One of the things I understand is that the hedgerows are disappearing, and this is where the bees used to get a lot of their nourishment, and now they're being wiped out. And, you know, I was talking to your partner the other day, or your associate, Zach, and, you know, he was saying that farmers are out there trying to squeeze every nickel they can, so they'll take the hedgerow area, and if they eliminate all of them, they can plant more crops, and they can make get a few more bushels in. And in the long run, that sounds like that might be really harmful to bees.
Yes, the tree lines that were, you know, developed and planted by the Conservation Corps back in the 30s as a buffer from the Dust Bowl erosion are now succumbing to commodity pressure. We're losing those environments and the floral diversity that was within those. We're losing the conservation land. In the last 5 years, we've lost 10 million acres of CRP in the upper Midwest. And we're seeing wetlands and native prairies all tilled and converted to commodity farming. And, you know, who'd blame the farmers with the type of prices that we're seeing nowadays? But we're just not leaving any wild places or any habitat for the bees or for the other, you know, tenants of those ecosystems. And it's no big surprise that they're suffering.
I just like to speak up, you know, and share the blame. It's not lay it all on the farmers because they're suburban homeowners.
Yes.
Who plant lawns and ornamental varieties that have no pollen or nectar contribute to this loss of resources. Mystifying to me, at least, management of roadside rights of way, which eliminate blooming flowers just for some arbitrary concept of highway beautification.
Oh, are you talking about planting turf along highways?
Yeah, that sort of thing? Yeah, or why? I mean, it's certainly justifiable to maintain visibility, but why roadsides have to be strafed and reduced to biological deserts is another practice.
And a lot of people call lawns biological deserts.
They absolutely.
And here's one of the problems is when I go to a garden talk, people say, how do I get rid of clover? And I say, why are you trying to get rid of clover?
Good for you.
What is wrong with you? It attracts pollen. No, well, you know, come
and it
on.
It fertilizes the lawn.
I know it's taking nitrogen out of the sky for free, putting it in your soil for free. It's producing pollinator attracting flowers, and so there are people out there who tell you, maybe Zach, you agree that the white clover honey is the best honey in the world. I don't know.
Well, certainly from a North Dakota perspective, it is. but yeah, that's an issue. It's an attitudinal barrier that has been fostered by many, many years of trying to produce aesthetically pleasing yards and ball fields and on and on and on. And May's right. It's not just farmers. It's everybody. We all have a stake in our environment and what's available to grow food, and we have to consider that. I think it's also policy. You know, we've got crop insurance that is allowing crops to be planted on land that should never really support it, and those are places that perhaps could be left for pollinators and for other animals.
Well, this is all part of that farm bill discussion, isn't it?
Well, yeah, as well as the conservation policy within that. You know, we're losing those critical CRP lands. You know, in the last farm bill, we really emphasized and prioritized conservation, but we didn't invest in it. We invested in other parts of the agricultural systems, like the crop insurance. And, you know, is it any big surprise that farmers aren't rushing out to enroll land into conservation? There's just not enough profit there.
Yeah, and we don't. You're right. We don't push it. And I can't. Do I think that this current Congress will pass some enlightened law in the next couple of months regarding farmers? No, it's not going to happen. We have a bunch of dunderheads in Washington. So, you know, that's when you say it's complex, it just keeps getting more and more and more complex. I want to reintroduce everybody because I realize I haven't. Dr. May Barenbaum is in studio from the University of Illinois. Zach Browning, you just heard, is a fourth generation commercial beekeeper out in North Dakota. And the name of the company, it's Browning Honey Company, right?
That's right.
And Jeffrey Pettis, Dr. Pettis is with the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Beltsville, Maryland. Jeffrey, you've been quiet for a little bit here. Anything you want to bring up?
I have a number of things, but well, first I'll just speak a little bit just to what Zach and May touched on as far as forage and availability. What we have to do, because I'm from the Department of Ag, we have to find a way to balance modern agriculture, and we need everything from these large scale farms with, you know, that are growing things like corn, rice, and wheat at a large scale, all the way down to the backyard or the community garden. We need all of that to meet our growing food need, but we have to. Even with the large agricultural settings, I think, unfortunately, it's going to take
a national effort to get some habitat back into those larger farming systems. So I think we can do it. I'm not going to speak about the Congress and what they do or don't do, but basically we're going to need a concerted effort, CRP and others, to get some useful vegetation for all kinds of wildlife, pollinators, pheasants, birds, ducks, whatever. Get that back into the environment. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I'd just like to touch on real briefly is that some of the talk about pesticides, and May touched on it brilliantly, was that bees evolved feeding on two pure products, which nectar is really pure, and pollen by and large is pure. And the reason there's a lot of attention to the neonicotinoid group, the systemics, is that we can find them even at low levels in nectar and pollen, particularly in pollen. So it's a little troubling that even at very low levels, that's the food that bees and other pollinators are using. So that's the reason a number of people are doing studies on looking to see if they're there and see if they're causing harm. And what we're finding is that, yeah, they're there sometimes in low levels, but we're finding a lot of other things in the mix as well. So, yeah.
This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk. Ted's been waiting very patiently on line one. You're on the Mike Novak Show. Good morning. Ted? Are you there, Ted? Well, maybe he wasn't waiting as patiently as I thought. Ted, you sure? All right. 773-763-9278 is our telephone number if you want to jump into the conversation. All right, let me pose a ridiculous question here. And I think, Rob, let's see if we can get Dr. Whalen, and I think he's working on that right now, from Michigan State University. All right, if we're causing all these problems, and you talk about all the substances that are found in this very pure, what was once pure, nectar and pollen, why don't we just ban certain products? Why? I mean, would the whole agricultural system of the world collapse if we didn't have neonicotinoids, or if, you know, we did something else? What are we talking about here?
I don't know who wants to field this one, but
go ahead.
In terms of precedent for bans, Europe.
I mean, Europe just did that. They banned neonics for 2 years.
Three neonics
for 2 years is what I meant to say. And that actually leads to my question, which is they practice the precautionary principle, which is they're saying they're erring on the side of caution and saying, well, we're not sure, like the three of you have been saying, we're really not sure. But just in case, we're not going to use these for 2 years. Why the heck can't the United States do that? And you and I talked 6 years ago, May, and I said the way it works in this country, or maybe you said it, was we throw out a chemical and then 10 years later we go back and say, maybe that wasn't a really good idea. So why can't we just do that here?
Well, part of the problem is it's not clear what to ban. Banning three neonics.
All of it. I was being facetious.
Remember that you were talking about Congress. EPA is a government agency, and there are many constituencies to whom Congress answers, I guess.
Yes.
Well, I recently heard from a pollinator advocate, a lobbyist, who refers to CCD as congressional collapse disorder. So maybe that's a little...
Ooh, I like that. Wait, where's... That gets a ding.
But U.S. agriculture, for better or worse, has evolved in the context of pesticide use. And the problem with banning three specific neonics is there are many other neonicotinoid products. And what's more alarming is there are many other products that are demonstrably worse than the neonics. And in fact, the neonicotinoids were introduced as being environmentally more compatible than some of their predecessors.
Since the organophosphates, perhaps?
Organophosphates are really nasty, and they have been used. They can be used systemically. One problem with the neonics, and not so much banning the pesticide, but the practice, the use of systemics violates 40-plus years of hard-earned knowledge of integrated pest management. And the same thing applies to the use of antibiotics. You do not use antibiotics prophylactically because you end up selecting for resistance among bacteria.
So you're saying here that the use of systemics, which is the neonicotinoids and others.
And fungicides.
And fungicides. It goes against the tenets of
IPM.
IPM, integrated pest management.
You don't treat a problem if you don't know you have the problem. It's very...
We're doing it prophylactically.
It's very seductive. It's insurance. These formulations and preparations are cheap enough that farmers can, and you can't blame them for wanting to, you know, look at the bottom line, apply these pesticides just in case.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the lessons of the 1960s showed clearly that just in case is not a really sustainable strategy.
Jeff, were you going to jump in there too, or was that Zach?
Well, yeah, I was just echoing what May said about it. A lot of these products are being used as, we'll call it crop insurance. If you do X, Y, and Z, you treat the seed, you do this and that and the other, you'll end up with a set amount of yield at the end of the season, and the commodity prices are such that the farmer basically can't afford to not do that. But the other thing is we've gotten away from what used to be, we used to have an extension service in most areas of the country that advised the farmer. Most of that advice now is coming from other parties, shall we say, that have developed products that can guarantee a good crop. But so they're encouraged, the farmers are encouraged to use these products even in the absence of the pest, which is what May was saying. I mean, we're using them prophylactically, we're using them just as insurance against what might happen. And it's resulting in overuse, basically.
So why, if we're overusing them, why don't we fine people? Why don't we pass? I mean, there is a bill that has been introduced by Earl Blumenauer of Oregon and John Conyers of Michigan called Saving America's Pollinators Act of 2013. And I assume that has a bee's chance in a spray of nicotinoids of surviving.
Let me just correct the term overuse. In this case, I meant overuse. It's being blanket applying seed treatment or whatever to every situation, which, like May pointed out, goes against integrated pest management. You're targeting the same pest in all parts of the country, and they may not even be a problem maybe every once in 5 years. So it's that type of overuse. They're using it actually according to the label. That's a different discussion.
Yeah, but you're right. It's used to every situation, then it is overuse. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. In case you just joined us, we're having a pretty intense conversation about bee loss. I want to bring in a couple of people. Let's go back to the phones. And guess who came back? It's Ted from Melrose Park. I'm glad you're back with us, Ted.
Boy, I hit my mute button by accident.
Oh, is that what happened? That's why you weren't there. Okay.
You have the most important show of the year.
This may be.
I want to take yours, and you probably turn it into a podcast already.
I'm going
I learned all about bees down at the Garfield Park Conservatory. When we went down to see the plants out in the field, they had beekeepers. And they had hives with glass sides, so you could actually see it in production, which was it just snapped my tree. I have my neighbors bordering. Their backyards are on Forest Preserve property. And we're going to take at least three homes and set up beekeeping so I can get a hold of the dude way up out in West Browning, I think, and find out what he can bring to the table here. This has to be delivered to people in such a way you hit them in the head with a 2x4. And then you say, look, you must stop flushing your drugs because Terry at the Water Reclamation District said sooner or later that ends up in the ground, in the water supply.
Well, there's no doubt we've put a lot of different chemicals into our environment, and we do it with... It's a holdover from the days when we thought we had endless amounts of land and water.
Sure.
I mean, my goodness,
exactly.
We used to dump our effluent into the ocean.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, who was speaking there?
I was. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No problem, Ted. Continue on. And then,
General Assembly, I spent 18 years making laws and broke a few. But I learned when you're talking to a farmer and you're talking to a beekeeper, I'm not sure they can coexist. We have water problems all over this place.
They used to coexist. Let me put it that way. Didn't they used to coexist?
Exactly. We've got to get it right back there. The faster, the better. There is no one that has an anticipation clock ticking as fast as mine, I might suggest.
Mm-hmm. All right.
We've got to get back there because the farmers are tiling their fields.
running the water faster into the streams, flooding downstate. It's just a great big vicious circle. So,
all right, well, Ted, I
should carry on, make a story out of it, and I'll take it out to my people. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
And I'm going to put this podcast out there. There's going to be a podcast of this, and May, you had your hand up, and I think maybe Zach might want to comment as well.
Well, one of the reasons, the nature of the relationship between beekeepers and farmers really has changed over the past century. And part of that has to do with what Zach Browning referred to earlier, the loss of sort of unmanaged land, because along with the loss of that unmanaged land, the U.S. is experiencing a loss of native pollinators. So there are something on the order of 4,000 species of bees in North America. But because they themselves are facing challenges finding enough food and habitat to maintain themselves, U.S. Farmers are relying more than ever on managed pollination services. And at this point in time, the only reliable, deliverable managed pollination services are controlled by beekeepers. So Zach can speak more to the point of the rising price of colony rentals, because farmers have no alternative. 100 years ago, you could plant a crop and then the local insect fauna would take care of it for you without even, you know, a thought on your or preparations on your part. But we have there's an additional crisis that's ongoing, and that involves our native pollinator community. Honeybees are our premier managed pollinators, but pollination services historically have been contributed by a very diverse insect fauna, which is now experiencing losses.
You're talking about native pollinators as well, and are these pollinators under attack as well?
Well, one of the problems that we have that we don't have with honeybees, people haven't tracked them over time. But now that this awareness has been raised and people are monitoring, there is clear evidence that there are certain groups of native pollinators in big trouble, including 4 species of bumblebees, one of which may already be extinct. Bumblebees are terrific pollinators.
And of course, 50,000 of them died in Oregon. And I said earlier in the show, due to stupidity.
Stupidity, exactly.
Is what that was. Zach, do you want to comment before I bring in another caller?
No, absolutely, Mike. You know, May really made some good points. And, you know, back to the coexistence issue, there's the food supply to be considered. 90% of the crops in the U.S. at least get some sort of benefit from bee pollination, and a third of our food crops depend on bee pollination. And so you think about it in that context, that's mandated coexistence. If we don't work with those farmers, we don't have enough food to eat. And on the other hand, there's the unmandated coexistence, and that's where when we're not engaged in that commercial pollination job, we have to have a place to put those bees, and they're related because if we don't survive through the rest of the year, then we're not there to do the job next time. And so we can coexist, but it's changing, and part of the reason it's changing is because the new technology in chemicals and farming is not evaluated the same way. EPA looks at pesticides now with totally different modes of action and totally different chemistries, the same way they looked at DDT 50 years ago. And until some of those evaluation methods and standards change so that we can actually appropriately label and understand how these compounds work in the environment, we're going to have a continued problem and a lot of unknowns out there. That was part of the reason why the European Union decided to take some extra caution. But we have a unique problem here. We're not really comparing apples to apples when we're talking about Europe agriculture and what we have here, which is very large-scale farming, very, very high-tech farming, where we've created environments where there's very little plant diversity, which makes them very susceptible to disease. There's large acreages, which makes them very, very hospitable for the pests that we're trying to control in those crops. And because of that scenario, we're more dependent on chemical here than we are in Europe. And so it's a lot more difficult to say, well, let's just ban these products. We've got some real issues to deal with. Really what it comes down to is finding a way to bring sustainable practices to conventional farming. If we can do that, which we've made a pretty good effort at doing it this far, and that's why we're still surviving, then I think we can continue to coexist. But it takes understanding and commitment from everybody.
I want to bring in another call here. By the way, it's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. Dr. Mayor Barenbaum is in the studio. Dr. Jeffrey Pettis is in Beltsville, Maryland. He's with the USDA Agricultural Research Service. And Zach Browning of Browning Honey Company out of North Dakota is on the line. Let's bring in Dave from Milwaukee. Dave, it's good to hear from you.
I could listen to you guys all day. What a wonderful show today, and very sad to me. Dr. Barenbaum, I had a class with you years ago back in Illinois with Bob Metcalf. I worked with Bettina Francis.
Oh, my goodness.
Folks. And still working on pesticide issues, both nationally and internationally. But I had a couple questions. These new, what they call pseudopyrethroids, these non-ester pyrethroids that are being sprayed around for for mosquitoes and things, are those having an effect because they last longer in the environment? And the other question I had was, what are some of the other chemicals that they are still finding in pollen, and are they insecticides?
Well, with respect to the new generation of pyrethroids, one of the acaricides approved for use inside the hives is tauflavonate, which is a pyrethroid. Bees are actually quite sensitive to pyrethroids in general, and the reason that tauflavonate can be used in hives, it's slightly less toxic than the other pyrethroids, and in fact, we've shown in our research at the University of Illinois that pesticides interact with each other. They're synergistic interactions. Remember, there are fewer detoxification enzymes in the honeybee. When different substrates compete for access to the detoxification enzyme, you end up with synergism or enhanced toxicity. So,
isn't that, to interrupt? I'm sorry, but isn't that one of our problems? Is that we don't look at how these various chemicals interact with each other?
Absolutely.
When we do a discussion of here's the toxicity of this such and such a chemical, that's it alone, and yet it's interacting with a couple of dozen or even more chemicals out there.
Yeah, as I mentioned, 121 different pesticides and metabolites. This was from Mullins et al. 2010, an excellent study that I think Jeff was a co-author on, very sensitive chemical analyses of residues. And what they found in the pollen nectar, pollen honey, bee bread, or bodies of the bees or wax included every class of insecticides, so carbamates, pyrethroids, neonicotinoids, insect growth regulators, chitin inhibitors, all of those were found. In addition, fungicides, multiple classes of fungicides, every kind of pesticide, actually, that you can imagine that's used in U.S. agriculture shows up in hives. So
herbicide as well, yeah.
The potential for synergistic interactions is limitless.
Well, and I think that's a really important point. I mean, even at the most basic level, at least they should focus on additivity.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't know whether they make each other worse, just add them together toxicologically, and if you can do that. But the other comment I wanted to make, and then I'll hang up, was, the comment about whether we can get along without bees. Almond growers, to rent bees for the almond growers in California is almost prohibitive. And at a prairie enthusiast conference up in Minnesota earlier in the year, there was a presentation on whether, 10 to 15 to 20% of the land being put back into natural systems could, in fact, compensate for some of those losses. So, again, great show, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling, Dave. And unfortunately, we're just about out of time here because I have to I'm going to get to Jordan Parker in just a little bit. But I wanted you guys to kind of put this in perspective here. You're the folks studying this, but people listening probably want to know what they can do. And what would the recommendation be? Jeff, maybe let's start with you, Jeff Pettis.
quickly, the homeowner can do a lot in just reducing the use of their own pesticides. Pesticides used by homeowners, the label rate is much higher than the farmer ever uses. So that's one way. The other main way, I think, and this is for mostly honeybee keepers, but also for native pollinators, we've got to find a way to get some diversity back in the ag environment. And I think that may have to happen at the national level. We have to provide some incentives, but we've got to find a way to get some diversity and plant diversity back out in the ag environment. So we always need this big ag. We can go all the way down to smaller and smaller farms and more diversity like they have in Europe. But we're going to have to balance that need. So getting some nutrition back in the environment for honeybees and other pollinators, I think, is key.
Zach Browning?
Yeah, Mike, you know, I think that trying to make this complex issue simple really comes down to a commitment to research, better understanding of new pesticide technology so that we can implement the type of use recommendations, best management practices that are required in order to protect pollinators and other organisms. And then on the other side of it, I think that we all have to learn to engage in more sustainable practices throughout all of the resource ecosystem management scenarios, not just agriculture. Mm-hmm. And if we can do that, we can provide additional diversity and probably long-term sustainability that we can practice. And that's what I think we have to do right now in order to make a difference.
Jeff Pettis and Zach Browning, who you just heard, thank you so much, gentlemen. I hope we have this conversation again. I want to talk further about this. And thank you for being on the show this morning.
Thank you. Thanks, Mike.
All right. Take care now. Bye-bye. And as we let them go, May, in, you know, a minute or so, what would you advise?
Keep caring. Right now, this is the issue of the moment, but those problems are not going to go away. And I'm incredibly gratified by the fact that people actually do care about bees and reevaluate weeds. I mean, weeds are actually wildflowers growing where somebody doesn't want them.
Yep.
And in fact, wildflowers do have a place and a function, not just in farms, but here in cities and in suburbs and in rural areas. So two things. Don't stop thinking about the bees and think a little differently about the weeds.
Good points. Hang on. We'll talk in just a second. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. This is one of my favorite factoids. Did you know that prospective home buyers decide if they are interested in a home within the first 2 minutes of seeing it? Trees and landscaping have everything to do with that first impression, adding immensely to a home's curb appeal. They can add as much as 20% to a home's value. The Care of Trees can help you sell your home faster and obtain top dollar for it by ensuring that your home landscape is as attractive as possible. Even relatively minor expenditures on landscape improvements can pay off. Pruning, mulching, edging, and replacing damaged shrubs can make a big difference in the length of time on the market and the selling price. Make the Care of Trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Invite the certified arborist to take a look at your trees. Call 800-508-9466 for a free consultation. 800-508-9466 or go to thecareoftrees.com. The Care of Trees, a Davy company. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I don't want you to be left out. Here's what I'm talking about. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakening Chicago to improve their lives than any other health or wellness magazine. If you're a green, natural health, or wellness business, you should be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Natural Awakenings is packed with information that our readers use to find the products and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is available for free each month throughout the city and north and northwest suburbs. We're placed in more than 1,100 area locations, ensuring the right eyes read about your products and services. We're also online at nachicagonorth.com. We're local, we're independent, and our readers will help you grow your business. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Lace wings and genomes, we are in the dog days, regardless of what Florence and the Machine says. And if you don't get that reference, I'm a lot hipper than I thought I was. So what happens in the dog days? Well, if you're reading the July-August issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, you'll see that the question for the Ask the Experts column is, What are the most common gardening myths you hear from your customers? John Heaton from Knooper Nursery in Palatine says it's misidentification of crabgrass. Platt Hill from the nursery of the same name in Bloomingdale and Carpentersville says it's the comment, I need lime to sweeten my soil. Dave Christakis from Alsip Home and Nursery in Frankfort, Illinois, in St. John, Indiana, has this gem. You can't plant anything before Mother's Day. And Rick Del Visco from Anton's Greenhouse and Garden Center in Evanston has the flip side of that myth, which is it's okay to plant tender annuals and vegetables on Mother's Day or May 15th. Then there's my favorite myth, which is that people read my column on the inside back page in the hope of actually learning something. Silly people. Bust the myths, folks. Get a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. Go to ChicagolandGardening.com or call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600. Let's go right to the phones. Bring in Jordan Parker, who's with the Bring Your Bag Chicago campaign. Jordan, how are you this morning?
Great. How are you, Mike?
All right. You've been hanging out at Garfield Park yesterday, and you're going to do it again today. It's something mm-hmm. called Figment.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you there?
We are there to spread awareness of the massive environmental problem that plastic bags are creating.
Yes, and I've been working with you on this for a while. We're trying to get an ordinance passed in Chicago City Council that would reduce the number of plastic bags in the city. We encourage people to bring your own, and that's why Bring Your Bag Chicago started. You can go to the Facebook page and like them. You can go to the Indiegogo campaign. And how much money have you raised so far?
We've raised about $2,000 mm-hmm. so far out of our $8,000 goal. And there is so much support for this. Yesterday at Figment, we were just swarmed with people around our display. Our display is a pop-up tent, and we have about 85 strands of plastic bags fanning out around this canopy. And it looks kind of cool from afar. People kind of wander over. These plastic bags are gently floating in the breeze, and then they come up to our signs, and they're like, oh, this is a really bad problem.
Yeah, well,
how many bags are consumed every minute in Chicago? 2,568 bags.
Let's say that again. 2,568 plastic bags are consumed, are given out, are used in Chicago every minute.
Every
minute.
And yeah, when you see that, when you see that number, it's like, oh, okay, that's a lot. But when you see the actual bags. This is how many bags 2,568 is. It's like, wow, this is a huge, huge problem.
Yeah, and go to my website, MikeNovak.net, and on the homepage, I've got your installation, a photo of your installation, and you can see those 2,568 bags and what they look like all at once, strung out on lines.
Yeah, it's really powerful. And people ask me all the time, like, well, why do we want an ordinance? Why does this have to be a legal matter? Why can't we just encourage people to bring their own bags? And when you see this insulation, you realize it's because there just isn't time. There isn't time to knock on everyone's door in Chicago and say, hey, can we talk about plastic bags and how this is a really bad, you know, environmental problem? And can I encourage you to bring your own bag? We just don't have the time for that or the resources. We have to cause sweeping change immediately. This is a huge problem. Every minute, in the past minute that we've been talking, another 2,568 bags have been consumed, and 90% of them are landfilled, or they end up in our trees, in our lake, in our environment, in our parks, everything.
And they break down, and as you and I know, Steve Wilson from Five Gyres was just out on Lake Michigan, and they were doing a survey of the water, and they're going to have a report come out really soon, and it's going to be scary. It's going to show that mm-hmm. the Lake Michigan is filled with plastics the way they found out Lake Erie. Is just got all this plastic. We don't know what it's doing to us. We don't know what happens when fish ingest it, and then we ingest the fish mm-hmm. and other creatures. And this is what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I prefer to look at the dark side. You said the reason we have to do this is because, well, frankly, that's human nature. People won't do it unless you give them the stick instead of the carrot. Sometimes.
Yeah.
And let's you know. And if you bring your own bag, nobody loses. It's very easy. I bring my own bags to the store all the time, and that's our goal. So
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a win-win. People don't understand that these bags are not free. They cost us over $40 million. That cost is hidden in our grocery bill.
Exactly.
And we are paying for these bags.
So you're at the Figment today from what, noon to 5?
Yeah, noon to 5 at the Garfield Park Conservatory. So you go into the conservatory, and Figment is in the back in the park grounds, and it's just a beautiful space. It's completely free. Yesterday, there were a ton of people.
Sorry about that. That was a mistake.
It's a really eclectic mix of people, just people from all walks of life, and no money is exchanged. We're giving away free cottontail bags. We're screen printing them ourselves.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Really, I'm going to encourage people to go to Garfield Park, see the Figment and the bag thing, and you and I will talk soon, because this is not done. It's far from done.
It's far from done. We're just starting.
Yes. All right, Jordan. Take care now.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And I want to thank everybody who was in the studio today, everybody who participated in the conversation. And at this point, we just say go green or
go home.
Go home.